Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the inherent limitations on the extent to which technology can improve our lives, and what are the hazards of ignoring those limitations? Few of us would willingly return to a pre-internet world, and most of us are happy to have instant access to information and global connectivity. But my guest today worries our embrace of 21st century technology leaves little room for critical analysis of its darker side, from big data surveillance of our every click and post to our increasing outsourcing of thought and memory and decision-making to machines. Evgeny Morozov is contributing editor to The New Republic and a contributor to publications including The New York Times, The Economist, and The Wall Street Journal. His newest book is called To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Evgeny, welcome back to Think.
Good to be here.
What is technological solutionism?
Well, as you have described, technology increasingly allows us to do more and more things and to solve problems in completely new and unprecedented ways. And I think in the last 5 or 10 years, we have noticed that we no longer ask critical questions about many of those problems. So how they are composed, if you will, how they become problems, is something that we also need to think about critically. There are many ways in which a problem like obesity or a problem like climate change can be tackled. Tackling it through technology or apps is one way to go. But there are many other efforts. We can go and engage in reform. We can regulate the food industry. We can go and invest in infrastructure. I mean, there are all sorts of other options. And I think in our excitement about what technology offers and how easy it is to build a sensor into everything and how easy it is to track everything now that big data has suddenly become a buzzword, we no longer critically question many of those problems. And I think we should. So solutionism for me is this intellectual tendency which doesn't ask critical questions about what problems are worth solving and how. And it simply presumes that a given problem is a problem based solely on the fact that we have a nice and shiny technological solution available for fixing it.
You give us as a prime and truly ridiculous example this recent invention of something called a bin cam, which is basically like a camera mounted inside a trash can lid.
Yes, well, it's so-called smart trash can. I mean, there are a lot of smart devices now. Smart is another of those buzzwords that I take a very critical view of. And by smart, we often mean that gadgets and devices have some kind of interactivity built into them. They can show you feedback. So in this particular case, you have a smart trash can which has a smartphone built into its upper lid. So every time you open and close the lid, it takes a photo of what you have just thrown away. And that photo is being uploaded to the internet where freelancers are paid to analyze whether you are engaging in recycling friendly behavior or not. And then you're being assigned points. And the whole point, the whole goal of the project, if you will, is to earn most points. And whoever wins most points on Facebook then becomes the winner. And this is another very interesting use of what a lot of people in Silicon Valley at least call gamification. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this tendency to turn everything into a game and thus to motivate people to do things, in this case recycling, that they might be reluctant to do before. And what I'm arguing is that we do have the infrastructure for solving a lot of problems. In this case, you can solve a problem like recycling by turning it into a game. But just because we have the infrastructure doesn't mean that that's the right way to go and that perhaps we want citizens who actually think about climate change and who think about ethics, who think about recycling, and don't just approach it as basically consumers, as another way to earn frequent flyer miles. I mean, there is something deeply political in this solution, and we need to talk about it as well and not just focus on efficiency alone.
Yeah, and of course, there's the danger that as soon as you remove the reward, assuming that people have formed new habits, they will no longer be motivated to do this thing.
Well, that's one of the big discoveries of the last few decades of sociology of incentives. I mean, there are a lot of scholars studying how different incentives of both monetary and non-monetary kinds affect our behavior. And the discovery so far is that when you ask citizens for some kind of sacrifice, when you tell them that we are going to build some kind of industrial wasteland next to a village, and if that's the only option available, some citizens would say, okay, I mean, we will live with this. If you then instead offer them cash, fewer of them would accept it because they think that it's no longer a political demand on them as citizens, but it's something that they can just easily opt out of. And I think many of similar things we'll see when it comes to gamifying things like political participation. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who want to boost civic engagement in America by rewarding people with points for showing up at the election booth, again, on the election day. Now it is possible because we all carry mobile phones, we're all on social networks. So again, it is possible to gamify elections, but we also need to ask, do we want to? Do we want to turn something that used to be about politics, morality, and ethics into another act of consumerism where you're acting, where you're earning points that you can then redeem into a latte?
Do you sense, Evgeny, that Americans are in some way unique in our faith in innovation and technology, or is this really a universal phenomenon that we come to first by virtue of our relative wealth?
Well, I think historically there are different time periods where you can clearly see that. You know, there was a lot of excitement about innovation and technology in Germany in the 1950s or 60s, mm-hmm. for example, with consumer electronics, with Braun, which then inspired Apple, for example. So, I mean, historically, of course, this is not unique. What is unique, I think, is that Silicon Valley as a center of power, if you will, as a global center of power, not just national, is growing in importance and its cultural significance is growing. And you see people from Silicon Valley increasingly offer solutions to problems that have nothing to do with entertainment or nothing to do with their business model. Just this week, you have probably seen that Eric Schmidt has co-authored a book that just came out where he is trying to argue how we can solve problems like terrorism, how we can address the problem of drug trafficking in Mexico, and he's pitching solutions that do come from Silicon Valley. So the very fact that Silicon Valley exerts such a huge influence on American life, of course, somewhat changes the discussion about those things in America. So in that sense, I do think that America is quite unique, at least in the last decade or so.
So talk about this. In discussing these issues, we often tend to draw a line between internet culture and the culture as a whole. Do you see that as a false dichotomy?
There are clearly people who believe in the internet as some kind of a natural force, which is almost like nature. So you have people who make arguments that the internet follows a series of laws and it's going to have predictable effects on how society operates, and all we can do is just to reshape our political and social institutions accordingly with what Wikipedia tells us or with what Google tells us about how the world works in general. So there is this tendency to look at the success of a site like Wikipedia and then to argue that it reveals something fundamental about how the world works that it didn't know before, and we need to go and remake the rest of our world accordingly. That's why you see efforts now in politics, for example, to completely transcend political institutions like parties and instead come up with some kind of a more liquid system where citizens can just join each other and campaign on issues by bypassing the party system. There are efforts like this to read some kind of exceptionalism into digital culture. I find them very suspicious. I have a term for such efforts. I call them internet centrism. And what I do in the book is to investigate what kind of claims, and the reform claims especially, it allows people in Silicon Valley and outside to make, whether it comes to things like making government more open or, as I've said, transcending the partisanship that, again, is presumed to be a problem simply because we have the solution available for fixing it. Hmm. Right? So there is this interesting relationship between solutionism on the one hand and internet centrism, whereby the internet as a cultural phenomenon entitles us to think that all of the imperfections of both individual existence as us as citizens, but also of political institutions and social institutions. All of those imperfections, whether it's the hypocrisy of politicians or the opacity of how our political institution works, all of them are considered to be bugs in the computer speak, which can be and should be eliminated. That's, I think, what's happening, and that's something that I think we need to counter, and we need to embrace, if you will, and rediscover the beauty of imperfections, both at the level of institutions, at the level of individuals. So we need to think harder about why inconsistency matters, why hypocrisy matters, in small doses. I'm not saying that we should all become hypocrites, but there is clearly an argument to be made that we need to preserve some of those vices in order for our society to function. And I fear the Silicon Valley doesn't recognize that.
Well, let's talk about that hypocrisy question, because we have this nascent and growing ability to sort of catalog every political statement that is ever made, every document that is issued. And although it might be natural for public figures to relate to their constituents by framing the same argument in different ways depending on the audience, now such efforts at effective communication do often get shot down as hypocrisy, if not outright untruth.
Well, you're right. And I think what has happened in the last 10 or 15 years is that a new kind of infrastructure has emerged for keeping politicians in check. A lot of people building this infrastructure, and I'm talking, of course, about technological and media infrastructure with automated databases that can store everything that the politician has ever said or tweeted, or all sorts of nice automated systems that can actually spot inconsistency, even in their tone. Now we even have linguistic analysis of the intonation in which they deliver their statements. And I think the emergence of this infrastructure basically ties the hands of many politicians, and it leaves them even less space. And very often, they tend to say even less than they used to, in part because they fear that it might contradict what they have said before. To some extent, we have seen a similar effort when freedom of information laws were passed in many countries. A lot of politicians stopped putting their thoughts in writing and in memos, and instead switched to just talking or speaking on the telephone just to avoid those restrictions. So in some sense, we achieved even less transparency. But I think this idea that somehow politics should all be transparent and consistent, I just don't find it to be a very realistic portrayal of politics. Politics is all about bargaining and finding and building alliances, and very often it involves saying different things to different audiences. But I think that was obvious to the founding fathers and to Plato and to many thinkers throughout philosophy. And we have lost that realization in part because we have the tools available for getting rid of hypocrisy. But just because we have the tools doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in some kind of broader philosophical discussion about its merits. And that, I think, is one of the key features, negative features of solutionism, is that it's not interested in any kind of philosophical debate or philosophical discussion. It simply seeks to impose a set of tools that are already out there to get more efficiency or get more improvement without actually asking what counts as improvement to begin with.
Evgeny Morozov is my guest. He's a contributing editor to The New Republic and author of the new book, To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. We'd love your input on this or your questions. You can get to us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or join the show via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Evgeny Morozov. He's contributing editor to The New Republic, and he also writes for The New York Times, The Financial Times, The Economist, and The Wall Street Journal on occasion. His new book is called To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Evgeny, if I go to the mall and buy a sweater and somebody says, absolutely, we'll sell you this sweater, but we want to know the last 10 purchases that you made. And by the way, we're attaching something to you so that we can know the next 10 things that you're going to buy. I would run screaming out of that store. But somehow that happens to us all the time online, and it doesn't even strike us as typically particularly threatening.
Well, that's right. We do see a new digital economy that has emerged, which seems to us very benign. And a lot of what we get is free and beautiful, and we enjoy many of the services we get. But of course, they do not come free. In part, the reason why all of the services exist and why they proliferate and why they're so accessible is precisely because they're free, and they are free only in as much as we don't have to pay for them with money. But we do have to pay for them with the data. With our personal information, we have to disclose more and more, and some of it, I think, we'll regret eventually once a lot of this seemingly inconsequential and trivial data is being aggregated, and once it's put into databases and analyzed, and even seemingly trivial things will matter. They will disclose far more about us than we imagine, and I think a lot of us, those of us at least who are not the most successful people who have risky thoughts, who have risky ideas, will come to regret it. And this is something that we need to think about, in part because those of us who do not have risky ideas and who are quite successful have strong incentives to disclose how healthy they are or how safe they are driving. And that's why you see this new generation of apps and sensors that are everywhere. In our cars, you can now wear a sensor on your body to show that you're walking enough and that you're exercising enough, and then to prove it to your insurance company. I mean, there are good incentives built into the system for people who are quite successful and well off to basically claim their benefits. Because if you can show that you are driving safer than the average person in the proverbial spreadsheet of your insurance company, you can reap off some benefits. And then the trick is whether those of us who refuse to self-track and who refuse to monitor actually have a genuine choice, as Silicon Valley assures us. Because when everyone else is tracking and we don't, the assumption that a lot of institutions would make is that we have something to hide. Mm-hmm. And when this is the broader cultural and political climate in which we make our decision whether to self-track or self-monitor, of course, we have far less choice than we are promised.
Right. Refusing to provide that information essentially means that we're cut off from whatever service is being offered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about this. It seems to me that a lot of people would be much more alarmed by all of this if we could have a look at a packet or at a file of the information that has already been gleaned about us online and attached to us, whether by our credit cards or by our sort of, IP address or that sort of thing. But this is not even information that we, am I correct, have a right to under the law?
You mean the information that's collected about us?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of technology companies, especially Google, has been quite cagey about even telling us how a lot of the information they collect will be used eventually, in part because they themselves don't know what services that they're going to roll out in the near future. I mean, if you look at Google, for example, last year they passed something called Google Single Privacy Policy, right, which brought together a lot of services like YouTube or Google Calendar or Gmail under one privacy policy, basically. And before that, whatever you did on YouTube was not connected to what you were doing on Google search engine, and it was not connected to what you were doing on Google Calendar, for example. Now it's all connected, and Google can make predictions based on your interaction with many of those services that it runs, and then build new services based on those predictions. So now, because of this new privacy policy, it started a new app called Google Now, which basically tries to analyze everything that you do with different Google apps and devices, and it tries to predict and make predictions and do things for you that you would have done otherwise. So if it knows that you have a plane reservation in your email somewhere, it will automatically check you in. It will check the weather at your destination and tell you that you need to bring an umbrella, and it will tell you that the traffic is really bad on your way to the airport, so you need to leave sooner, right? And this is only something that is possible if Google can track everything we do across many different sites. And in Europe, politicians have asked Google specifically with regards to letting citizens and users know what that data is used for. Google refuses to do that. So they have no incentive. And right now, the way most of our laws work, we have no rights to that data either. And that's very unfortunate.
And sometimes, of course, companies move ahead with plans that they assume are good for us or will sort of be met with consumer demand without thoroughly considering the consequences. Can you talk about the privacy gaffes of this service called Google Buzz?
Yeah, I mean, Google Buzz was one of the services that Google launched a few years ago. And the idea there was that, Google for a long time wanted to be in the social networking business. And they've tried several different approaches. And Google Buzz was one of the first. And they thought that one way in which to grow the audience and the number of users to the service would be to automatically enroll all of the Gmail users, the users of Google Email service, into the system and to have people that they correspond with the most as their default friends. So basically, everyone who was in my automatically generated address book on Gmail would become my default contacts on Google Buzz, and that information in itself would be publicly visible to other people. And of course, that was a disclosure of a lot of our contacts and relationships that many of us didn't expect. There was a huge backfire, a huge backlash against Google. A lot of dissidents also in places like Iran and China began being very concerned and worried that their contact list would be available to the government suddenly. And Google backtracked. Now I think they're much smarter when it comes to new services like Google Glass, which is just about to hit the market, in part because they know that there are huge privacy implications for such services. So they do it in a very limited manner. They ask people to volunteer. They run some kind of an auction. They make it look like an exclusive VIP system. And that solves some of the problems, but it also builds excitement for a service like Google Glass, which, frankly, I still don't know what it's actually good for and why we need it. But since it's marketed in such an exclusive and in a limited way, of course, people want to have what they don't have. Right. And that creates a demand on its own.
All right. I'm so excited that we're talking to you this week because, of course, last week there was, as a function of big data, the FBI was able to identify the suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing and ultimately publish those suspects. That turned out to have worked out in terms of apprehending the people believed to be responsible. On the other hand, there were also early on some individuals identified through the media that turned out to be, as far as we know, entirely uninvolved.
Sure. I think we should not really credit big data with helping to identify those individuals, in part because a lot of the tips and a lot of the actual information about the suspects came from just analyzing video footage from the privately run CCTV cameras. This is not, a set of algorithms that recognized them. Actually, most of the facial recognition systems failed to recognize them, and they didn't recognize them at all, actually. So a lot of the excited claims we've heard in the past that now with facial recognition software we would be able to prevent acts of terror didn't work out. At the same time, of course, we saw a very bizarre series of hunts and manhunts of their own on social media, where sites like Reddit try to engage in their own investigations, and they jump to conclusions prematurely. And that, I would say, wasn't unexpected. In the last several years, we have seen similar efforts. They don't only exist in America, by the way. In China, there is something known as human flash search engine. This is a fancy term for a group of Chinese internet users who basically try to identify some corrupt officials spotted in some picture, or, you know, go and identify who did what. I mean, so it's an established part of internet culture, not just in America, but also elsewhere. But I think we also need to be a little bit critical as to what value, to use the expression, good police work actually brings, right? And it might be that there is a good reason why we have police, and there is a good reason why this work is done by professionals, and it's not done by internet amateurs. And it's not just because professionals are better than, and experts are better than hobbyists and amateurs, but it's because also you want some kind of a secrecy in which you don't want to implicate people who might be innocent. And I just don't think that that culture and that recognition that there is a value in secrecy and in evidence and in sticking to some kind of a paradigm where you actually need proof to show that someone is a suspect, I just don't think it exists in social media. So again, in some sense, it is a very interesting manifestation of this phenomenon of solutionism, where on the one hand, we can engage in this crowdsourced investigations, but we also have lost sight of what actual police work is for and why we want certain things to remain secret up until the very end. And I just don't think that the online culture has this recognition.
And to your point, there are a lot of people who say, who don't say, well, maybe we shouldn't try this. People say, well, we just have to wait till it gets better. Like, you know, had this happened 5 years from now, it would be ideal.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the belief that more data will always be better, right? So the idea, if we only could analyze, if we could just install more cameras and have more sophisticated facial recognition systems, it would be able not just to identify those suspects, but to just by analyzing their facial emotions and expressions, we would actually be able to preempt the crime. I mean, this is what we've been hearing ever since 9/11. There have been a lot of efforts to install so-called facial expression technology in airports so that you can actually identify suspects before they board the plane just by analyzing their facial expressions. That technology hasn't exactly taken off, but there is clearly this impulse and this urge to argue that if only we had more sensors, if only our databases were more expensive, if only our algorithms worked faster, then we would be able to not just solve but to preempt things. And I think this idea of preemption is also something that we need to consider very carefully. In part because, as I actually argue in the book, there are a lot of biases that you can incorporate into your algorithmic prediction software, and it happens all the time. We don't have a very good system to audit such systems. We don't have an public auditor that steps in and examines whether some of the predictive models we use for predicting crime actually incorporate some biases about race or income, or whether they just don't incorporate all the data about unreported crimes, right? This is one of the dangers of relying on big data to predict future crimes. If right now some crimes are underreported for various reasons, we will not be incorporating them into whatever predictive models we are building, right? So, I mean, there are all sorts of questions here on the table about the value of prediction and how prediction can go wrong. And I think we need to be having those conversations and not just celebrating that what algorithms can deliver. I mean, they can also misfire very easily.
So I'm really fascinated by this idea that very shortly people will have the ability, should they so choose, to quite literally document their entire lives with technology. Right now, we can pull out a phone whenever we want. There may be ways to sort of take a photograph of what's going on in our lives every minute or so and have an entire life packed in. And I wonder what you think, if that actually is to happen and people start choosing to do it, how that would change our relationship to our own memories and the way we use our memories to make meaning out of the events of our lives.
Well, I think there is this mistaken belief in a lot of Silicon Valley cheerleaders and enthusiasts, and this belief is that as long as we can wear some kind of Google glasses or a portable camera on us 24/7, we would be able to record everything about that happens to us, and somehow it will be able to relieve everything just by watching many of those episodes. And I think a lot of it is very naive. I mean, in part because you don't want to record. If you record everything, then you understand value of nothing, right? And I think we need to be able to do things selectively. And very often, the lack of photo, the lack of a video can actually make our mind work in ways that we couldn't even anticipate. It will stimulate our imagination and make us relive the experience in a much better way, because we'll come up with all sorts of narratives. I mean, that's one of the reasons why someone like Marcel Proust, one of the foremost writers and thinkers about memory, the French writer, you know, he actually didn't like the idea of cinematography and photography, cinematography especially, in part because he thought that it will degrade the narrative experience that we all come up with when we have to think, rethink through that, you know, baked cookie that he was thinking about or something else from his childhood. And I think in Silicon Valley, there is this tendency to reduce everything to just data and to facts and to record 24/7 everything around you. And then, of course, they don't really realize how exactly you're going to navigate all that footage. You know, I don't think that anyone will really enjoy when you go on a holiday to go and just record every single moment of it, just via camera at the beach for 2 weeks. And then, you know, you do not expect those 2 weeks of footage to adapt to a memorable film, right? You still want some editing. You want some highlights. You want to assign meaning as to what's important, what matters. And many of these automated systems don't have that capacity. And of course, there are all sorts of privacy implications on top of that that, you know, we've already discussed. But I think we do need to start with a somewhat more sophisticated model of what memory is for, how it works, and the role that we ourselves play in constant narrating our own experiences. We cannot delegate that narrating function to an algorithm, right? We ourselves want to make meaning of what we see, and we want to relate it to our previous experiences. And this is not something that we can simply outsource to an app.
My guest is Evgeny Morozov. He is contributing editor to The New Republic and author of the new book, To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. You're welcome to join the show by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Evgeny Morozov about his new book, To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Evgeny, in the last segment, you were talking about the sort of cheerleaders for the tech industry. And it's worth pointing out that there aren't too many industries where the people covering in supposedly a critical way that industry are as deeply engaged with technology as the men and women seem to be who cover the developments in Silicon Valley.
Yes, but you'll need to unpack it a bit more.
Okay. Well, in other words, it seems that many tech journalists are predisposed. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn here. Predisposed to believe in technological solutionism.
Sure, but again, I think technological solutionism is just one of the many structural misunderstandings of technology journalists. But yes, I mean, it has to do with the fact that a lot of what they write about it doesn't seek to ask any questions about morality or politics or values. It's coverage of gadgets mostly. It's coverage of the latest startup and what venture capitalists are investing in. And now we have, I think, a very dangerous situation where a lot of technology blogs they have writers who are also investors, and, you know, there are lots of conflicts of interest there, which doesn't necessarily lead to more critical coverage of the technology industry. So, yes, I think we need more critical questions. We need to be much clearer about the conflicts of interest that exist in this industry. But we also, I think, need to deflate some of the exceptionalism that is also in the air. There's a lot of people thinking that we are living through yet another Gutenberg revolution, and that the internet is like the printing press, and that everything is possible now, and we no longer need to think about institutions or reforms, since we can all do it all with the help of technology and apps. I mean, that's one of the more dangerous things I find, and the overall backlash against institutions. I think now we see it more and more. I mean, it started first with journalists and the idea that bloggers can do a better job, or at least you sitting at home don't need to go and read your local newspaper. You can just go and build your own newspaper from RSS feeds right in your laptop. Mm-hmm. And now we are seeing the same discourse that we saw about journalism spread to education. So you no longer need to go to school. You can just sit at home and watch all of those wonderful video lectures or TED Talks or do those MOOC courses that everyone is excited about. The same rhetoric is also now applied to healthcare. Why do you need doctors if you can just sit at home and use your smartphone, which is equipped with sensors to detect your, to check on your health or detect any symptoms? I mean, there is a lot of this anti-institutional rhetoric coming from Silicon Valley, often hidden in this rhetoric of disruption. Everything is to be disrupted these days, regardless of the value that it brings. And I think we need to be a bit critical about just who is disrupting whom and why, and what are some of the institutions and practices that we ought to leave undisrupted. And I think in this mad quest for innovation and disruption, we stopped questioning what are some of the important political and social accomplishments, including institutions, whether it's journalism or universities or doctors that, or experts for that matter, in other fields that we want to preserve. And alas, technology journalists have not served us well. In this regards, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having all these good shows.
Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah. I wanted to comment, I guess, and then ask Dr. Morozov a question. The older I get, the more it seems like culture is really hard to change, and that culture is connected to individual development, so that your culture or part of the culture is only going to be as good as the thinking of the people or some of the people in that culture. It's an evolutionary process, and I think religion and spirituality are that same way. So my question is for Dr. Morozov what's he thinking about how to change the culture, and does he think there is some spiritual element to us getting out of stuck at the level of thinking where we are? And I'll take it off the air.
Thanks for your call, Jim.
Sure. Well, I mean, there are a couple of ways. I mean, I can only speak for sort of my field, which is technology criticism. And here I think we need to be much more critical about language. And that's something that I already hinted at in my previous remark. I mean, there are very interesting things happening to our language, in part because we, as I've also noticed already, mentioned already, Silicon Valley is playing the disproportionate role in setting the terms of our debate. So now we want to build everything. Every institution needs to be hackable. Right? Hackability suddenly, all of a sudden, has become a buzzword and a goal that we want to cultivate in our culture. How did that happen? I think it's a very important investigation. The same happened to openness. Now everything needs to be open, and we have open government, and we have open education, we have open online courses. How did open become such an important goal? But also, did the very idea of openness change from, say, 1990s till now, right? I wrote an essay recently where I argued that up until 1998, for example, when you spoke about something like open government, you actually meant government that was accountable to its citizens, where citizens could exercise some control over what was happening. Now, open government means something very different. It basically means government that releases its data in friendly and portable formats so that geeks and NGOs can build databases very easily, right? But we no longer ask what kind of data is being released, whether it actually improves accountability or whether it improves transparency, right? So the North Korean government, if tomorrow they decide to release data about their labor camps, but they'll do it in some data-friendly format so that a set of geeks can build databases based on that data release, that will count as an improvement in government openness, even though it's done strictly for propaganda purposes and has no impact whatsoever on how the North Korean government functions, right? Something happened at the level of language that troubles me profoundly because it allows a lot of governments in the West to get away with claiming that they're promoting government openness while they're actually promoting the very opposite. So you have the British government under David Cameron suddenly say that they don't like freedom of information laws and they actually want to start charging potentially for freedom of information requests, while at the same time they would claim that we are the biggest believers in government openness because we release all of our reports in formats other than PDF. And that's not the kind of openness that I would like to see in government, even though I do like open data formats. So we need to be very critical. And one way to change culture, I think, is to be more critical of the language. And that's why I've been urging a lot of fellow critics and intellectuals to do.
Let's go back to the phones. Once again, this time we have Hadra on the line in Richardson. Hi, Hadra.
Hi, thank you for this topic. I find it very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering and wanted to ask about the impact of images on our memory in a negative impact. To what extent does it cheapen it? Because we hear a picture is worth 1,000 words, but there are some memories that are based on other than a physical image or a visual thing, stimulation. It's more like the feeling or the smell or the emotion behind a memory. But when you have a picture there, it almost kind of supersedes all of those things because you remember what you see more in a way. So doesn't that physical picture or image limit or direct our memory?
I agree with you that when it comes to memory, I mean, there is this tendency now with these cameras, especially in Google Glass, to focus only on the visual at the expense of all other sensory criteria. But again, Silicon Valley would solve that problem. I mean, they would find a way to record smells and then to reproduce smells as well. I mean, if there is one problem that I think Silicon Valley can handle, it's that one. The extent to which to the extent to which it will be ubiquitous, the extent to which it might displace the role that imagination plays and how it will change our imagination, how it will change how our memory works, I think are very important questions that, again, we need more novelists and people who do, humanities and who do literature to tackle. I mean, right now it's just engineers tackling those problems. And my fear is that when engineers are forced to think about memory, their primary metaphor is the computer, it's the hard drive. And I'm just not sure that that's the way in which human memory works. And if you start to rebuild human memory with the hard drive as your primary metaphor, you might end up with a human memory that looks exactly like a computer, but that's not the kind of future where I think we need to go.
So to the extent that this technology forces us to sort of remake our lives to accommodate technology instead of the other way around, Evgeny, what are the most effective ways for us as users, as consumers, to push back against that?
Again, I don't think that there is anything necessarily wrong with technology. I mean, there are many wonderful apps and many wonderful products that can make us think. I mean, that's one of the, I think, criteria that you as a user and a consumer should look for in a technology. When we hear about technologies that are smart, quote unquote, what is meant by smart right now is that it's a technology that does things for you and it actually replaces you as an active decision maker. quicker. And very often, I think that's what we want. But obviously, you cannot generalize this to every single instance. If technologists just automate everything about us, and if they spare us from any decision-making, then there will be nothing for us to decide, and there will be no obstacles for us to overcome, and life will become very, very boring. And we will actually probably will find it intolerable because there will be no opportunity to grow and nothing to strive towards. I mean, so the role that friction and active deliberation plays, I think, is very important. But again, technologies can also force us to think. They can force us to liberate. They can force us to have conversations. Towards the end of my book, I have a chapter on design where I talk about a particular philosophy of design called adversarial design. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of artists now are building all sorts of household appliances that kind of malfunction, but they malfunction in a mischievous and playful way. So it's not a kettle that will explode in your in your hands, but it will do something different every time you use it. And in that sense, it will make you aware of the fact that it consumes electricity and that probably you need to think a little bit harder about how much energy you're consuming. It wouldn't necessarily give you the answer that you're consuming far too much electricity or far too little. But it will force you to think about the role that energy plays and the role that you can play as a citizen in reducing your own footprint. So I think from that end, sick technologists that are not just problem solvers, but also problem makers, troublemakers. And I think it's only by embracing such technologies that we will recognize just how irresponsible many of our own behaviors have been up till now when it comes to energy use or when it comes to things like privacy. We just assume that we can continue living in this information economy without making any changes, and suddenly now we see that all of those databases are full of data about us, and eventually it will come to haunt us. And perhaps it may have been wiser to either pay for some of the services or to have them provided by the public sector, right? And that's only something that you recognize once the databases are already full of personal data about us.
We just have about a minute left, but as a society, what can we do to promote deeper introspection on the part of technological innovators? Is that a job for the education system? Do people just all need to read your books? What do you suggest?
Well, I think we need to bring people who are not just engineers to the table. We need to find a way to have artists and novelists and people who do humanities to sit at the table along with the engineers and to convince engineers that efficiency is not the only goal that they should be striving towards.
Evgeny, we actually do have a few more seconds to go. People should know you're not a Luddite. You engage with technology. You're a critic of the way we use technology and your concerns. But you are as plugged in, probably at least as plugged in as the next American.
I hope so. I mean, again, I don't think that you can actually criticize technology by either being a technophobe or a technophile. I mean, technologies all have very different logics. And if you already start from the assumption that there is something that unites your chair with your iPod and that they all promote efficiency, I mean, you're already probably on the wrong path. You need to analyze every technology in its own context and on its own terms and not have any broad metaphysical assumptions, whether positive or negative, about what technology or technologies do.
Evgeny Morozov's new book is called To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Evgeny, thank you so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. And, of course, we welcome comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.